One day, Marcus Appleby floated to the shore and we found him. So he's going to talk about some of these new techniques today. Okay, so I probably should explain the title. I've got a sort of aversion. Well, I've got a real problem with the terminology in this subject, which is not of my invention. I mean, that's sort of two terms run together. SIC stands for SIC, POVM, Symmetric Informationally Complete Positive Operator Valued Measures. And MUB stands for Mutually Unbiased Bases. And if you say all that off, it's just a kind of nightmare. So I guess you have to use abbreviations and I just sort of run it together to make one word. I mean, I think the SIC is particularly unfortunate, really, because it's got kind of digestive connotations that I prefer to avoid, really. But we seem to be stuck with this term. In the title, Symmetric Information Complete Positive Operator Valued Measures, that's emphasizing the fact that these things do form a kind of measurement, which is definitely a very interesting kind of measurement. However, they're really, I really want to take the emphasis a bit off the measurement aspect. I mean, what we're talking about is a structure in quantum state space, which tells you something, you know, it's got a relevance to measuring things, and tomography, but it's got that relevance because it's a certain kind of geometric structure, and you might want to use it for other reasons. I'll point out one thing you can use it for in the course of the talk. But really, I just want to focus on the geometry of quantum state space as such. So if we're talking about a two-level system, D equals 2, as everyone knows, we have the block sphere picture. So you can write an arbitrary density matrix like that, and the pure states sit on the boundary. And as you go into the middle, it gets more and more mixed, and that's a very nice, simple picture. The problem with it is, of course, that as soon as D is bigger than 2, life gets a lot more difficult. I want to use a parameterization which is as close to the block sphere picture as possible. So I'm going to write an arbitrary density matrix in dimension D like this, where B is an emission matrix with trace 0. And it's convenient, again, keeping the block sphere picture in mind, to define an inner product on that space as 1 over d minus 1 trace b1, b2. And in fact, that completely reduces to the block sphere if you put d equals 2. B then just corresponds to n dot sigma. And this inner product is just the standard scalar product of your two n vectors. The difference when you're in an arbitrary d-dimensional space is that, as in the case of the block sphere, you've got a sphere of radius 1, but you've then also got a sphere inside that with radius 1 over d minus 1. So d is 2, of course, the radius of the inner sphere is the same as the radius of the outer sphere. But once d is bigger than 2, that's not the case. And then the collection of all density matrices lives inside that generally speaking, it sort of runs between them. That's diagram has got no pretensions to accuracy. That is a more or less a possible two-dimensional section of this structure.
What does the inner sphere correspond to?
Well, every state inside the inner sphere is a possible density matrix, so it's positive. But as soon as you go outside the inner sphere, in some places you get operators that are positive. They're the ones inside the thing I've outlined in orange. And outside it, you get things which are not positive.
Where are we getting this different? In the two-dimensional case, you've got the vector n.
Yes.
So where does the sphere crop up in the generalized representation?
Well, I mean, it's in terms of this inner product. So the outer sphere is defined to consist of the B matrices you get such that that's one. They're trace zero. So in other words, if you take trace B squared, you get D in the D minus one. And then out of that B matrix, you construct the density operator like that. It's just a way of, it's just one way of parameterizing the state space. I mean, it's one
quite like, I think. There are other choices, of course. I like it because it makes the analogy with the D equals 2 case particularly sort of apparent.
Clarify, the inner sphere contains all of the B vectors for which rho is guaranteed to be positive just based on the norm of B. And the outer is the one containing everything that could be positive. Everything outside of that is guaranteed to be negative. Is that right?
Well. Basically, everything inside this orange structure is positive. Everything outside is
yes.
And the point is that this is just one particular two-dimensional slice through an object with many more dimensions. And as you take different slices, you get different shapes. I've drawn one where it actually touches the inner sphere.
There are plenty of sections where it doesn't actually touch. But what you always find is that the inner sphere is inside it. The inner sphere, and it's the biggest ball you can completely fit inside.
Intersect with the sphere? It's the biggest sphere?
I don't quite see what you mean. It intersects with the outer sphere.
No, in the inner sphere, you said you've chosen to draw one here where it intersects as though it's possible.
It's possible to have. If it hits the outer sphere, it always touches the inner sphere at a diametrically opposite point. But you can have structures, sections, where it doesn't hit either sphere.
But the ball, in some other dimension, the ball is saturating the dimension.
The places where it hits the outer sphere are the pure states. So in this particular picture, there are only two pure states. Of course, the pure states do actually form a continuous manifold. So the orange structure,
I'm going to call it the block body. I'll just call it B. So the orange ball has dimension d squared minus 1. It's a solid sort of object, convex body in a d squared minus 1 dimensional space. The set of pure states, these things, they form a continuous manifold, but that's only dimension 2d minus 2, which is, of course, a lot smaller. So the intersection of the orange thing with the outer sphere is a much lower dimensional but still continuous manifold. The continuity, of course, doesn't really come out in that two-dimensional section, nor in any two-dimensional section. It'll only intersect in a discrete set of points. So it's a kind of tantalizing sort of object because the dimensionality is very high. I mean, already if D is 3, this thing is an 8-dimensional space, and the set of pure states is 4-dimensional. So you've got this 4-dimensional manifold moving around inside a 7-dimensional sphere, the surface being 7-dimensional. And as you make the D bigger and bigger, that over that is of order D. So the disparity between the dimension of the set of pure states and the dimension of the outer sphere, it gets kind of more and more extreme. It's really much, much lower dimensional. And because the dimensionality is so high, I think it must be just about impossible to visualize. I certainly can't. It would be nice to understand it better. Obviously, understanding it better wouldn't really mean being able to picture it. There are people who have actually constructed loads of sections of this thing, but I don't personally think they help a lot. They have limited use. So you need some other way of trying to understand the geometry of this object. And that, to me, is a lot of the interest of Six and MUBS. Because, okay, this structure, although it's got this funny shape, it is, of course, convex, it's also very highly symmetric. Because if you take any unitary operator and you form that, that will move you to a new point inside the orange object. And when you move from the unitary operators defined on the d-dimensional complex Hilbert space to this d squared minus one real space, of course, we're talking about Hermitian operators, so it's a real vector space, those u's turn into ordinary rotations. And it's quite a big subgroup of the full rotation group of that structure. So although it's quite complicated, it's also highly symmetric in that sense. It's got a very big symmetry group. Now, the question is, what sort of structures can you fit inside it? If you've got an obvious place to start would be with a basis. So suppose we've got an orthonormal basis for the underlying d-dimensional Hilbert space. So you've got d orthogonal and normalized vectors, and you can go from those to the corresponding projectors, and from those in turn to the corresponding b vectors defined by this thing. And it turns out that if that's an orthonormal basis, the b vectors will always form a d minus one dimensional simplex. By which I mean that if you take this thing, you get one if r equals s, and minus one over d minus one if r is not equal to s. So if d was equal to 3, for example, then you're dealing with the 3 vertices of an equilateral triangle. If that's the outer sphere and that's the inner sphere, an orthonormal basis is like that. And with that particular section, the set of pure states is that sort of triangle. That's the section you get. It's interesting to notice that if you've got a basis and it's not orthonormal, the d vectors don't collapse down onto a d minus one dimensional hyperplane. They form they span a d dimensional structure. It's not a regular simplex. And okay, Now, one nice structure it seems you can form, you can certainly construct in some dimensions, is a set of mutually unbiased bases. Or MUBs. So in dimension 3, the state space has dimension d squared minus 1, which is 8 dimensions. A single orthonormal basis spans a two-dimensional plane with this simplex structure. And if you have 4 orthogonal ones, then that corresponds to a mutually unbiased basis. So you can form, I'll label them like this, so that's basis 1, basis 2, basis 3, and basis 4. And then if you take the corresponding B vectors, you get a two-dimensional structure for the B vectors from here, another two-dimensional one from here, and another one from here. So that's 4 mutually orthogonal two-dimensional planes, which of course span the whole space. It's not really, one can't exactly picture that, at least I can't. But you can see it's a very nice regular polytope, the sort of higher dimensional analog of a polyhedron. And the nice thing about it is it completely fits inside this orange structure. And that's a kind of surprise. I mean, it's far from obvious you can do that just at a first glance. And indeed, it's proven you can do that when d is a power of a prime number. But for every other case, nobody knows. So nobody knows if these things exist in d equals 6, for example. I think the feeling amongst most people who think about this is that they probably don't. But it's certainly not certain that they don't. So that's kind of telling you that's a kind of interesting geometrical feature. I think it's certainly a significant geometrical feature. I mean, MUBs are quite important structures. And their importance is really coming from the geometry. Now, a SICK is another sort of structure which is even simpler, more highly symmetric, which simply consists of d squared, you just take d squared vectors and you go from those to the corresponding projectors and from the corresponding projectors to the corresponding b's. And then what you get is a d squared minus one dimensional simplex. So if you're in D is 2, that's just an ordinary tetrahedron. For D equals 3, you're talking about an 8-dimensional sort of analog of a tetrahedron, and so on. And again, that highly symmetric structure completely fits inside the orange body.
To understand it better, could you give an example of how you go from the projector onto ER?
Well, simply in terms of that definition. Yes? So if this is ER, that's the projector. I mean, it's kind of almost trivial, really. You just define BR to be that, the color that you use in the. It's just a way of. I think to me it seems the simplest way.
Where does the D squared come from?
Sorry?
The D squared.
The d squared just comes from the fact that you've got the angles are all equal. So if you've got an equilateral triangle with those angles all being 120, so that's, these are now real vectors in a two-dimensional real vector space, then it's easy to see that E dot R dot ES is minus a half
if R's not equal to S. And if you generalize that structure, if you now take the vertices of a tetrahedron, you'd get ER dot ES is minus 1 over 3. And generally, if you've got a n-dimensional real vector space, and you've got n plus 1 lines all of unit length and making the same angle with each other, the scalar product's always minus 1 over n, if that makes sense.
I just wonder if the d squared, I'm counting the number of those.
D squared is because the dimensionality of the state space is d squared minus 1. So to construct a sort of analog of a tetrahedron, you have one more vectors than the. Now, the nice thing about 6 is that there seems quite a good chance. It rather looks as though MUBs do not exist in every dimension, though that's not certain. Conversely, it rather looks as though 6 may exist in every dimension. And this has actually been, they've been constructed numerically in every dimension from 2 to 45, inclusive, and constructed either using pencil and paper or computer algebra programs in dimensions 2 through to 11, wait a minute, 13 and 19, I think.
Actually, it's 2 through 13, including 12, 15, and 19.
Right, okay.
See, now we have enough evidence to think that it exists.
it's tempting to think they exist. I don't think you can really apply inductive reasoning here. For instance, with Mars, it seems quite plausible that they only exist when the dimension is a power of a prime number. So I don't know, there might be some weird sort of number theoretic thing going on here. Here's something conceivable. I mean, you could imagine that they only exist when the dimension is a product of no more than three prime numbers, in which case, three different prime numbers, in which case it would fail at 210.
Odd primes.
Sorry?
You mean odd primes?
Two primes. What about
32?
So
different powers of? But if it was more than three different prime numbers, then it would fail at dimension 210. That would be the first dimension. I just give that as an example. I mean, I have some reason for thinking that to be true. But on the other hand, nobody really understands the mathematics behind this. I mean, I'd like to point out that it's extremely surprising either of these structures exist from a certain point of view. Because, it's dead easy to construct a simplex that fits in this sphere. But you've then got to rotate it round so that every vertex is in that much lower dimensional manifold where the state space hits the outer surface. So if you're talking about D is 3, you've got to construct your tetrahedron, so to speak, in dimension 8. But you've then got to rotate it so that every vertex is in this four-dimensional manifold in the surface. And it's not obvious you can do that. In fact, it's almost surprising you can. I find it surprising. I was very surprised indeed by the paper by Brenz et al. In which they constructed these things numerically. I would have guessed they didn't exist before. So, I don't know. There's some kind of magic going on that makes this possible. And maybe the magic is quite sensitive to the properties of the numbers. I mean, Chris doesn't agree with this. Chris thinks number theory has nothing to do with it. But it certainly looks as though number theory has quite a lot to me. The number theoretic properties of the dimension. So it is, I think, an open question, and it's certainly not something you can just argue inductively, I don't think.
Well, I would guess number theory has a lot to do with the question of existence of mutually advised spaces.
Yes.
But I think it has nothing to do with the existence
of... Well, Sieg's, you may be right.
And
but
that's why I like that structure. That structure on the left better than that structure.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I was just pointing out that maybe at one point, once you've actually proved the things exist, then you can say this. We don't know. I just wanted to say that although at first sight that looks hugely impressive, I don't think it really makes it actually rock solid at all. It just makes it plausible. Okay. Now, why are they interesting? Well, for various reasons. They certainly are highly relevant to, for example, tomography. Here's another reason why they're interesting. If you're talking about the Bloch sphere,
you want to describe your state, so you can just construct an orthonormal basis. You can take three pure states, which are orthogonal relative to the inner product on the state space. And that's basically the standard description of the Bloch sphere. And I mean, that's why the Pauli matrices, well, it's one of the reasons the Pauli matrices are important, because they actually give you an orthonormal basis in the state space. And what you'd like would be some similarly nice coordinate system when d is bigger than 2. I'm not actually aware whether anyone's proved this or not. You might ask, is it actually possible to construct an orthonormal basis of pure states when d is bigger than 2? I've got a strong feeling you can't, and the reason I've got that feeling is because if you've got a pure state here which touches the outer sphere, opposite the orange structure has to touch the inner sphere. So if you had a system of d squared minus 1 axes and it was touching the outer sphere all around here, it would mean that it wasn't touching it around here. And that would mean that it was somehow kind of lopsided in some sense. So my feeling is that you probably can't construct an orthonormal basis relative to this inner product. That is, an orthonormal basis consisting of pure states. Though I don't know the proof of that. I haven't actually tried that hard. I keep thinking of trying to prove it, but I've never got around to it. Anyway, assuming that you can't construct a straight orthonormal basis in the state space, the next best thing, I would say, would be one of these simplices. So you've got a set of vectors, b1 through to bd squared, such that sigma br is 0, just by the general symmetry, and such that you have these nice angular properties. So that's not quite as nice as it would be with an ONB, where these would all be zeros. But it's kind of the next best thing. At least these numbers are all the same. Of course, you've got one more of these things than the dimension of the space, which means that if you want to expand an arbitrary state in terms of them, it wouldn't, of course, actually be a density matrix. If you want to expand some other B in terms of them, I'll call it A. You've got some freedom in choosing the lambdas, because it's an overcomplete set. But the fact that sigma BR is zero means that you can, in fact, you can easily see that if you require, you can always choose it so that lambda R is zero, and that if subject to that condition, that gives you a unique set of coordinates, which you might call simplicial coordinates. And because of these nice orthonormality relations, there's a very simple formula for getting the lambda R's in terms of the original A. It's just that with some constant in front, which I think, I'm not sure. I think it's d squared minus 1 over d squared, but I'm not sure about the constant. So it works very much the same as an orthonormal basis. And it gives what I think you might consider to be the most natural set of coordinates on this structure, assuming you can't actually construct a true orthonormal basis of pure states. And yes?
Because those are not orthogonal.
Yes.
Does that definitely work? You don't have to subtract off something?
No. Not, no. You see, I am imposing that requirement that the sum of the lambdas is zero.
And that kills the...
That kills the constant you'd otherwise have.
So the... If you write, oh, okay, so if you take one of those BRs,
yes,
and you expand it in this basis.
If you take one of those BRs,
you'll have to all of them.
No, if you expand one of the BRs, you'll get lambda R itself is 1 and the others are all 0. No, you won't, of course.
Right.
You'll have 1 plus d squared minus 1. Well, you'll have negative numbers here. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, quite right.
Yeah.
You said earlier,
you're saying it's not clear whether or not you could have a set of n squared states. So d squared states that were actually orthogonal?
D squared minus 1, yes.
Isn't that just true by definition, just that the Hilbert space is a d-dimensional Hilbert space assignment which allows the maximum of d orthogonal states?
Yeah, but the thing is that if you've got two vectors here such that that's 0, and then you form the projectors, P and P dash, and then you go from those to the corresponding B vectors, it's not true that B dash is 0. It is in fact minus 1 over D minus 1.
It's a different sense.
Yes.
But if you have an equiangular set, then...
Do you mean an equiangular set in the D dimensional vector space, the original Hilbert space?
It's the same thing. If all the inner products between the states are the same up to phase, then...
This inner product.
That's right.
Yeah.
If those are all the same up to phase, then all the inner products between the Bs are the same up to
yes,
phase.
Yes, that's first. Right. Yes.
So if you have an equiangular set...
Yes.
Then I believe you can show what that angle must be. If they add up to your condition, the sum of the b's is equal to 0. If you have that condition, then you can show what the angles must be. And I think that using that, you can rule out the case that you're talking about.
Okay. Yes. No. I mean, I'm kind of assuming there is a fairly simple proof of that. It's just that I never actually tried to construct it. But I'm interested. Yeah. I think I will skip what I was going to say. I mean, there's quite a nice condition you can put on, I mean, there's, I can't say it, so I'll move on. What I'm trying to say basically is that I think just proving existence of six in the first place would tell you something interesting about the geography of the state space. I'm also thinking that if once you've proven existence, you could use that natural system of coordinates perhaps to prove lots more about the geometry. It would be a good starting point for an investigation to try and understand effect. That's just a hope.
But I mean, if you're trying to understand a structure, a good starting point is to have a nice clean set of coordinates. So I'm thinking that these would be actually potentially quite useful. Though I haven't thought much about that at all, because I've kind of mainly been wondering about whether they exist in the first place. Okay. Now, the actual construction of these things always, in practice, involves using a group covariance property. Whether they have to have a group covariance property, so far as I know, is an open question. I mean, it's just, I think the reason it's done is because it makes it much easier to actually construct them. So the idea here is that you have some set of unitaries, and you have a single projector, single vector psi, which is usually called the fiducial vector. And you require that set of unitaries is closed up to phases. So you're allowed to have a phase in here. But if you multiply two of them together, you get another unitary in the same set. And then you form other vectors by acting with the use. Oh, and one of them would be the identity. So let's call that U1. And you form other vectors by acting with the U's on this initial starting vector. And the reason that makes the construction so much simpler is because to do it numerically, for example, you use the fact that they're constructed numerically by minimizing that quantity, which is technically called the frame potential. And you can show it's always bigger than or equal to some number that I can't remember. And if it's actually equal to that lower bound, then you've got a sig. Now, if you just started off looking for an arbitrary set collection of vectors, you'd be dealing with d squared variables, and it'd be horrible. But if you assume this group covariance property, it makes life a lot simpler, because you simply have to minimize this. And basically, you just have to look for the one vector psi, and the others all drop out. So that's the reason in practice that the ones which have been found have all had this group covariance property. And it's not really a reason for thinking there don't exist six that don't have it. And who knows, they might even be simpler in some sense, if they exist. Okay, in practice, almost all of them, the particular group that is used usually is what's called the Weyl-Heisenberg group. And for this, you take a standard basis, and you define a Z operator, which does that, where omega is a dth root of unity, and an X operator which shifts you by one, and then when you get to this last vector, it takes you back to the beginning. And then you form an arbitrary displacement operator by taking suitable pars of these things. So you can define that. It's convenient, actually, to stick a phase in. Anyway, that's the simplest way of defining it. And then, because you've got two indices here, you've got d squared unitaries, and they have this property that they're closed under multiplication up to a phase, and you can construct your vector that way. Okay. Now, the other thing that seems to be relevant to this problem is, having got your set of Weyl-Heisenberg unitaries, it's interesting to ask for, I'm just going to write, give a single label P. So P stands for a vector with components P1 and P2. And you ask for unitaries that just take these displacement operators to themselves, possibly up to some phase. And the unitaries of that form that do that, well, actually, these d's themselves have that property. If you take a dq and do that, you get, in fact, a phase times dp. So they're actually quite boring. They just take a dp onto itself, apart from the phase factor. There are some much more interesting unitaries which do this. Where F is a 2x2 matrix. So FP means this. And the alpha, beta, gamma, delta are integers belonging to, so you take the group of integers modulo D, and these alpha, beta, gamma, delta belong to that, and you're doing matrix multiplication modulo D. And the determinant of F has to be 1 mod D, that is. There's a slight complication when the dimension is even, which I'll just ignore. And it turns out that those are basically, these are the general unitary that does this is always a product of one of these and one of these. I'm going to call these symplectic unitaries. You also have symplectic anti-unitaries, which do the same thing, but then the determinant of the corresponding F matrix is -1. And at least if you are in odd prime dimension, you actually have a group representation here, a true representation, so that if you multiply the unitaries corresponding to two different Fs together, you just get that, which, so far as I think that result isn't true in, well, it is true in odd prime dimension. I don't know about other dimensions. In other dimensions, you get a phase in front.
the finalizer.
It is the normalizer, yes.
And is the existence of that phase factor UDIKI, is that consistent with being a normalizer?
Oh, I see. All right. Well, okay. Then it's not technically a normalizer.
Something like it.
Yes. A projective normalizer or something. Yeah.
Okay, now the reason, well, there are various reasons why these things are interesting. The first reason is, if you actually construct these six, if you look at mutually unbiased bases, the expressions for them are quite nice. You've got nice, simple, closed form expressions for the corresponding vectors. If you look at the vectors for the seeks, they're just disgusting. That's the only word for them, really. If you do them numerically, you've just got a mess of horrible-looking numbers. If you do them analytically, so-called, well, there's one interesting feature, which is that if you actually look at the solutions, it seems you can always write them as complicated expressions involving square roots and perhaps occasionally cube roots. I mean, they're really horrible, like, for example, the one that Marcus Grassel constructed in dimension six using a computer algebra program sort of stretches to a sort of page, and the page is just covered with square root signs and roots of roots all over the place. But it's interesting that it always seems to involve roots. And I think maybe that's some sort of clue. Perhaps if one knew more about algebraic geometry, you could make some use of that. The other sort of thing that is noticeable is that it turns out that every single... Oh, I should explain that if you take these F matrices, the order of the F matrix, that is the smallest integer n, such that F to the n is the identity, only depends on the trace and the determinant, if we include the anti-unitary case. And in particular, if the trace of F is minus 1, that's mod d, then the order is 3. And it turns out that all the six that have been constructed so far, the fiducial vector is always an eigenvector of a unitary corresponding to one of these Fs. There may be a D in there as well, which is a kind of striking regularity. I don't know what it means, but it seems to be saying something significant about it. So that's a clue. Okay, so I will conclude by saying a bit about what I've been mainly thinking about over the last few months, which is the connection with what I'm going to call minimum uncertainty states. So assume the dimension is prime, you're in prime dimension. In that case, you know you've got a full set of MUBs. You've got D plus one mutually unbiased bases, which you can label. So you've got the first basis. So that's basis one, and then you've got basis zero, I suppose. I'm being a bit illogical here. 1 through to basis D. And suppose you're looking for a fiducial vector. Now, if you just work in a single basis, the condition for it to be fiducial is this. And that turns into some conditions on the components of psi, which are, of course, complex numbers, and they're sort of fairly, well, they're not that nasty. But anyway, they do involve complex numbers. Instead of that, you can look at just the amplitudes in each MUB. So you take the probabilities for each MUB, and square it. I call that PMR. So you've got there's no phases in there. That's just a positive number or non-negative real number. And then psi is a fiducial vector if and only if you have satisfied this system of equations. For each MUB separately.
The notation is PM comma R plus S, right?
Yes, sorry.
Yeah. So you have one equation where you're just taking the sum of the squares of the probabilities in each MUB, and then you have a further D minus one equations where you're shifting them relative to each other.
Okay, and those conditions are necessary and sufficient for this vector psi to be a fiducial vector for a sick POVM. Now, it's interesting to focus in particular on the equations you get when S is zero. So that gives you a system of equations like that. Now, those equations actually come up in a different context. Because this is something that Bill Wouters did with his student, Sussman. Where he was asking a somewhat different question. Actually, hang on, I'm not putting this right. Okay. Now, you can define something called the Renyi entropy. So the conventional Shannon entropy for the nth MUB would just be this. And this is defined differently, but it still provides a measure of how much the probabilities are spread out. So it's zero if one of the p's is one and the others are all zero, and it reaches a maximum value if they're all equal. So it tells you how sort of, well, how spread out the state is. And you can then consider the combined Renyi entropy for all the MUBs together. So that's the sum of those things, and I'll call that S. Now, what you're doing here is something a little bit like what you do with standard, in the sort of continuous case where you've got X and P. You have two observables, X and P, and you get the uncertainty relationship delta X delta P bigger than H bar over 2, and then for certain states you achieve the lower bound of that. This is a sort of related idea, except we're using an entropic measure of uncertainty instead of the standard deviation. And also, instead of just considering two observables, we're considering a family of D plus 1 mutually unbiased observables. But there's a similarity. You get a lower bound on this thing. It's always greater than or equal to D plus 1 log base 2 D plus 1 over 2, I think. And you get equality if and only if the S's are all equal. S0 is equal to S1 is equal to S2 all the way up to SD. And that boils down to, sorry, I don't mean that. I mean log base 2 of D plus 1 over 2. Which, of course, boils down, in fact, to the first of these equations. So what this is saying is that, yes, that's right, these equations. So if that's true, this is true for every MUB, and so you've got a state which minimizes the sort of combined Renyi entropy for all D plus 1 MUBs. So in that sense, it's a minimum uncertainty state. Now, that's something that Chris and I and Huan Dang did. And at the same time, by some odd coincidence, Bill Wudis was asking, he came across exactly the same concept, starting from what's really a completely different direction. Because he was asking for the discrete analog of a coherent state. And in particular, he was interested in states. So a coherent state, the Wigner function of a coherent state, has a nice rotational symmetry. And he was looking for states which have the same rotational symmetry, well, the maximum possible degree of rotational symmetry on a discrete phase space. And he was thinking that would be a kind of analog in the discrete case of a coherent state. And he was led to exactly this same idea of minimum uncertainty states that minimize the Renyi entropy. And in fact, actually constructed them when D is a power of 2. And that paper's on the archive. Now, these things, 6, do not have the same degree of symmetry, of course. They're a different kind of minimum uncertainty state. They've still got that order 3 symmetry I mentioned before, but it's not the same degree of symmetry. So there are many more minimum uncertainty states than the ones specifically that are sick caducial vectors. However, it suggests an interesting attack on the problem of trying to prove existence. Because there are a lot more of these things, you might hope to, first of all, characterize the set of minimum uncertainty states. And then having found that collection of minimum uncertainty states, zero in on the fiducial states, which are a particular type of them, which is K kind of the approach I'm sort of following at the moment. We've got as far as proving existence of these things in every prime power dimension. But that's quite a lot of distance still to go. Okay.
Have you considered maybe redundant representations, so more than V?
Redundant?
So here you say information is complete, and wherever you see that term, implicitly says just minimally information.
Oh, I see. Yes, well, I mean, of course, you might have a minimally an information complete here being with more than V squared elements, you mean.
Right.
Yes. I mean, obviously, that wouldn't be a sick. Because the whole idea of a SIC is that it's got this high degree of symmetry. The different vectors all have the same angle.
Couldn't you have more vectors?
If you wanted to retain the equiangular property. I mean, if you just think in terms of two-dimensional real vector space, you can have three vectors all making 120 degrees of each other. But as soon as you've got four dimensions, you can't have it so that any two have the same angle as any other two. So, yeah, sure, you could construct information complete POVMs that have more than d squared elements. And they might even be very symmetric in some sense. But they wouldn't have this sort of maximal degree of symmetry.
And then what about bases for these D bases which aren't projectors?
Yes, you mean a symmetric, you mean
just positive operator.
A positive operator value measure which has that symmetry and isn't a POVM. Yes, you can. I actually wrote a paper about that. It's on the archive. Yes, you that is a perfectly easy thing to define. Of course, they don't reach right out to the outer sphere.
Let me re-ask Chris's question, because I don't actually know. His name is Chris. I don't actually know the answer. So if you have n rank one positive operators, and you try to enforce the symmetry condition that the trace of the products is constant, then you can't have n larger than d squared. And we've written that up in our own mutual notes before. But if you relax the rank one condition, do you know that you can't have more than d squared?
Satisfying what condition? I think my attention wandered at a crucial point.
So you've
got more than d squared.
So you have some operators a sub r.
Yeah.
And you enforce the trace ar as is equal to a constant.
Yeah.
If ar is positive semi-definite, if all the ar are positive semi-definite, and they're all rank one, then there's a proof that both of us presumably know, because it is in my notes. There's a proof that there's that R can, then there's no more than D squared. But if you relax the rank one condition,
I think you'd still find it can't be more than D squared if they are, if you're requiring the trace ARAS is always the same. It just takes any two values, k1 if r equals s, and k2 if r is not equal to s. Then I don't see how you can have more than d squared, because you can't have more than d squared lines in a d squared minus one dimensional real vector space, such that the angle between them have the same length and the angle between any pair of them.
Oh, I see. So even if you relax the positive semi-definite condition,
yes,
you couldn't have more.
No.
color.
Are you
just here?
You're assuming these are permission?
Yes, I was. Well,
yeah.
Yes, I was thinking of them as being in a real vector space.
There, I believe that in certain real vector spaces, there are equiangular sets with more than d. Certain real vector spaces, there are equiangular sets with more than d plus one.
Really?
I'm not certain of that, but I think there may be a couple of examples where there are 2D.
You told me you found that, right?
That's in complex vector spaces. We know that in complex vector spaces, there are the sig POVM is a set of b squared that are equiangular, right?
Well, I've never actually written the proof out.
Are you talking about
things that came might have made a mistake, but I did think about this a long time ago, and I sort of satisfied myself on rough paper that you couldn't, and I've believed it ever since, but I suppose I might be wrong.
I'm assuming an arbitrary, if you allow it to be either K2 or minus K2.
Oh, yes.
No, I believe you're right there.
Yes.
So, often when you try to prove something for all cases of an integer, you use mathematical induction. So D plus one is true, D is true. But it looks like this kind of problem sort of makes that difficult. Because every case is a new situation. Is there any idea of how to use mathematical induction?
I've wondered about that. I mean, that was kind of my first thought when I first started to think about this.
Is there any relationship between subsequent cases that are known or that it's
not? None that I have found or know of, which is to say that it might be possible. I mean, it would be, in a way, the obvious thing to try. But as you say, it's very odd because you're dealing with very symmetric structures which seem to exist in every dimension, at least if it isn't 2D. And so in some ways it's very regular. There are all sorts of irregularities in the problem, and indeed every case seems to be different in many ways. So for instance, if you look at the orbits under the symplectic group, sometimes, when D is 5 or 6, you only have one orbit. They form a single structure, so any 2, 6 are related by a transformation using symplectic geometry. But when you go to D is 7, there are two orbits. I have no idea why, but... and again, they all have this property that the caducials are eigenvectors of an order 3 unitary, but sometimes they're eigenvectors of a bigger one. And the dimension 19 solution is an eigenvector of an order 18 anti-unitary. It seems that each dimension has some of its own individual character, and that definitely frustrates me. Yeah, maybe you can find a whole infinite family and you can prove it by induction. It would be wonderful.
Maybe just a quick follow-up to Lucien's comment. When you're constructing the simplex in real spaces, you can use induction, right? A tetrahedron is obtained by an affine translation of an equilateral triangle and adding another point. You keep doing that. The reason that it doesn't seem to work with sig POVMs is that there are weird phase relationships between the sig POVM vectors, and those change. You know, the same approach would sort of lead to a natural phase relationship, and there doesn't seem to be one that changes smoothly.
Let me try to mimic Lucien Harnett, since he's so tiny. At least if I can do it. Lucien always asks this question, which I think is a wonderful question. So one of the things that these kinds of studies show is how complex and how interesting the structure of quantum mechanical state spaces is. They've got this really interesting shape. is so interesting that it's difficult to ask questions like, can I fit a certain symmetric structure within it? On the other hand, you can ask, well, where do these state spaces arise? And the way Lucien asks it is, for instance, you have the same state space for talking about polarization as you do if you had talked about spins, or as you might if you had talked about quantum dots. These are physical systems that are wildly different in how you prepare the quantum states, but the state space structure is exactly is exactly the same, and it's this odd shape. Do you have any take on why that would be the case, that wildly distinct physical systems and preparation procedures and so forth would have exactly the same really complicated shape?
I think it's really the spirits.
I often wonder. I don't know. I mean, I guess that's why I think maybe if you understood that you're on trail better, you might start to have some ideas about why. I don't feel I understand the geometry at all, just in a very limited way. I mean, okay, these things seem to exist, there's surely a lot more to be said about it. And maybe if you understood it better, you might have some idea as to where this weird structure comes from. It's very bizarre.
You wouldn't get the glib answer that it's because states are information you can have about these systems, and information is fungible.
Is what?
Fungible.
Sorry, I have to tell you what fungible means.
Who is it who uses the rubber does?
It's a convention.
Yeah, okay, so it means interconvertible. My information about polarization can be transformed into my information about this. About quantum dots.
Yes, okay, but it still doesn't explain why it has this weird structure.
No, it doesn't explain why
it would have a weird structure.
But does it make it natural that they should all have the same?
They're all the same numbers.
Well,
I feel like Lucien asked this question.
One thing I think about is often in physics you'll see the same kind of behavior, right? Motion following conic curves.
Mm-hmm.
And then you say, well, that's a minute. Why does motion follow conic curves? Well, it turns out there is a deep reason for that. The Newton discovery.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be nice to know the same.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it was really mysterious to Kepler.
Yeah.
I mean, Kepler really disliked these conic curves.
Yeah.
He thought they were the biggest problem. And so, how long did he know? 7 years?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's not obvious,
so maybe the same is true here. I mean, sure, information is
fungible, but I'm not sure. Just trying to make some connection to foundations. Yes, absolutely. I can't sort of just take that and think, yeah, of course, I'll accept it.
Probably something which is next.
Yeah, is there an analogy for process tomography? Right, like seeks are sort of the nicest thing you can use to do tomography.
Yes.
Is there an analogous concept for process tomography?
I don't know.
Matt, I didn't have an answer to your question.
Okay.
So it's not now.
Not to me, anyway.
Okay. Within this room, it's not.
I mean, if you once found seeks, once you've proved basic existence, it raises all sorts of other questions, like, you know, for instance, if you have a tensor product of two spaces, how does the seek from the tensor product space prevent the seeks?
Please, thank Marcus.
Okay.